You know why I do this?
Why?
For the shorties.
Are we recording right now?
Yeah.
Did you get the ooh, ah, ah, ah?
I got something.
You watched The Keepers.
I did. And you watched The Keepers.
I did.
So that's kind of a weird coincidence that we both watched something and now we're going to talk about it.
And you actually watched it. You know, most of the time people don't do it.
Because you recommended it. Yeah, I know how that goes. Where you're like, you watch something and you really love it and you want to share it with somebody. And you're like, you go to somebody who you maybe respect or admire and you say, you should watch this so we can talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, yeah, I'll totally do that. And then they never do. So I know what that's like, but I also sort of understand what usually when I recommend things to people, that it's, usually some weird stuff that nobody actually wants to listen to or nobody actually wants to watch.
Right.
So, so in this case, it was something, oh boy, I hesitate to say good.
Really?
I have a lot of thoughts about it.
Okay. I want to hear your thoughts because you wouldn't tell me if you thought it was good or if you enjoyed it. Now, The Keepers is on Netflix. So let's
Correct.
Just say that.
Yep. So you can watch it. Everybody listening to this podcast has a Netflix subscription. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. Unless you're James and then you probably have like, what's that comedy one that you can
Oh, CISO.
Yeah. He's just got CISO.
That's probably good enough.
Do you have CISO?
No, but I probably would get more money's worth out of that than I would out of Netflix, honestly. And I think it's much cheaper anyway.
Yeah, it is.
You know what, James? I'm going to get CISO. We can rap about some comedy shows.
So what's your first thoughts on it?
So I would say the first three episodes are amazing.
Okay. Yeah, I can see where you're going with this because you're going to agree with me that at some point we kind of got a little lost on this one Jane Doe story. Is that what you're...
Yes, right. Yeah. I do have some thoughts about the Jane Doe story. But the first three episodes where they set up kind of the background, you know, mm-hmm. With these two women who were students in a Catholic high school and their favorite teacher goes missing and then turns up murdered.
Yeah, Gemma and Abby.
Right. Yeah, and you're going to be much better, I think, with all the names of everybody.
I've watched it all twice.
Oh, geez. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So in the second episode is when they really start to hit on the sexual abuse that was happening in the school. And they go into some pretty graphic detail on some things that were, where it was like, it was real uncomfortable to sit there and listen to these stories,
mm-hmm.
you know? And episode three is that when they got into the Jane Doe, Jane Roe case, or was that episode four?
I thought it might be episode four. I can check. I've got Netflix on my phone.
I have a computer right in front of me, too.
I'm going to go faster.
Okay. We'll see which one. We're racing to see who can... Oh, I got to...
Oh, no.
Do some things.
Oh, no. I'm having some problems. Okay. This is not going as planned. Why isn't it showing up? Do you ever notice that with Netflix? Sometimes you just want to look at your viewing history and then something's not there. And it's like, where did that go? Uh-oh, I hear the Netflix. Crap, you're going to beat me. I'm going to be so mad about it.
So episode three was The Revelation.
Oh, jeez. You totally beat me.
Oh, yeah. So episode four was more of that got into more of the details about... That was the 1994 court case so episode four was the Jane Doe, Jane Roe mm-hmm. court case against, Was it against both Magnus and Maskell?
Well, it was against the archdiocese, the nuns, I don't know if I remember Magnus being implicated, but also it was the gynecologist.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, that was, yeah. That was an uncomfortable story to listen to as well. It's like, and I don't know if we want to tell these stories on the shorty, just like, you know, I mean, there's some disturbing stuff.
Yeah, just disturbing in that a priest felt it necessary to send young women to the gynecologist and then accompanied them there. And that somehow somebody must have known that there was a relationship between a gynecologist and a priest, and how there was no, like, these early pregnancy checks, that kind of stuff, just messed up.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way they didn't know this was going on.
Right. And so that, I think, kind of starts getting into the heart of where I started to kind of have a problem with the series.
Okay. Yeah. When did you start having a problem with the series?
Well, it was really the somewhere in the episode of where the woman named that was Jane Doe, and I forget her.
Jean?
Is it Jean?
I think her name was Jean.
Okay. So when she starts kind of explaining or describing the process of remembering and, you know, like, recovering her memories is when I started kind of having a problem. Certainly, you know, there certainly is a lot of evidence to support repressed memories being a legit thing. You know, it's something that people have been through traumatic experiences. It seems to me that the consensus is that that's a real effect, that can happen. But it can also happen. Like, I guess what I'm curious about, in the way that some of the parts of the story were unfolding, I started to wonder if she was confusing actual repressed memories with things that maybe she just made up. You know, maybe she just made up, and and maybe it's something that she felt was, and I'm not saying like she just like crafted consciously to say, you know, to tell a story. I'm just wondering if maybe, you know, because what they showed her, she called it, you know, going into prayer, and they showed her, like, kind of sitting relaxed in a chair, and she said she would sit there for like an hour and a half at a time, and let things come to her. And so is some of that real? I certainly think that it's plausible that, you know, I'm not questioning like the integrity of everything she said, but I'm just wondering specifically about the story that she tells about seeing the murdered nun's body, where the Father Maskell, who's like the counselor of the school, as sort of a, you know, kind of a lesson to her about keeping quiet, takes her supposedly to see the body of the nun in the woods. And so what I wonder is, you know, like that sort of seemed, based on everything that we've heard, all the testimony that we've heard about this guy's, this priest character, that certainly sounds reasonably consistent with what you could expect from him. But Nobody else was there. There's nothing else. You know, the priest is dead now. You know, so there's nobody to. There's nobody to corroborate the story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so far after the fact, like, you know, and as malleable as human memories are, you know, I feel like a lot of people have, you know, this impression that our memories are recording devices, and that's definitely not the case. So, you know, is it something where, you know, she heard about the story, she heard about, you know, the crime scene, you know, and years later, in kind of this relaxed state, she has sort of a vision of what it would have been like had this event occurred, and it sort of manifests and feels like a real memory, but it's not something that actually happened. Does that, any of that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I would say that I do for sure believe her memories regarding the abuse, they were corroborated by, like, how many? They had 30 to 100 women come forward with similar situations, and it seemed to be pretty widely accepted that girls got called into his office regularly. And of course, there were other people who stated that, you know, Kathy, Sister Kathy, who's Kathy Sesnick, the murdered nun, you know, had even confronted Maskell in some regards, you know, oh, I didn't know she needed that kind of treatment.
Right.
So that, I do believe the abuse, and of course, ultimately, you have to wonder what her motivation would be. $50,000 was what she got from the church in a settlement, which really...
Well, and when you talk about motivation, like, I don't think that, you know, if she constructed the memory of going to see the, of Maskell taking her to see the body, I don't think that that would have been, it didn't seem like that was the kind of thing that she was making up for any kind of gain.
She genuinely believes it, but also doesn't believe that it's not true. Like,
well, I mean, you can have a memory that you believe is 100% real that never happened.
And so you think there's you think that's what it is.
That's what I think it is. Yeah, that it's
really?
Some sort of construct. Yeah, of
why?
Why do I believe that?
Yeah.
Well, because like I say, I mean, memory is very malleable. We're talking about decades of time passing, but, you know, between the time of, you know, the abuse and the crime, and to when she's remembering stuff. So, you know, it's entirely plausible that she, you know, heard an account of, and a description of the body and the crime, or, like, where, you know, like the scene where the body was dumped, and, you know, and constructed a memory around that, or, you know, like a sort of a false memory, you know, and it may be every bit as real to her as any other memory, but, you know, may not have actually happened. I mean, maybe it did, but, you know, it's plausible that your mind can construct that kind of stuff and you can be totally convinced by it that it's real.
Yeah. Of course, they did show that there could indeed have been maggots on this person.
Yeah, I was a little less convinced by that.
They were found in her mouth and in her throat.
Yes. But, you know, I guess what they didn't answer on that was what, you know, kind of what stage they were in, and whether or not it was, you know, because when she described seeing the body and brushing maggots off of Sister Kathy's face. And I guess it's, you know, like it's possible. But I was, you know, a little less convinced. It seemed like they were celebrating that fact, because it was an unseasonably warm November.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, flies were a little more likely to propagate in the warmer weather, where yeah. normally they would be dormant. You know, I guess that fact alone doesn't necessarily convince me that the memory was 100% genuine.
Well, and of course, it wasn't taken very seriously because they never did anything with it. I mean, generally, if somebody said somebody took me to a this person took me to a dead body, and it's a case you have yet to solve, you think they would be like, oh, well, we're interested in that. And Father Maskell was never... But remember they said that he was taken out of a church somewhere in handcuffs? Was that just for the abuse?
Yeah, they never really explained that, what that quote-unquote arrest was for. I forget who it was that told that story. Was that the dentist?
No, I think it was a cop. It was that retired...
Oh, it was the retired cop. Yeah. Okay. Right. And I forget his name too, but...
Yeah, and he was talking about how they don't do that unless somebody is, you know, legit in trouble. But okay, I can accept... Well, all right, let's just admit that Jean is a little out there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I liked her or not.
Yeah, I kind of went back and forth a few times as well, you know, as far as how reliable I thought she was.
But she spoke with great conviction, and of course I do believe she was abused by Father Maskell.
Oh, yeah, the whole angle of abuse is, you know, especially in, you know, this would have taken place in the late 60s, early 70s, and... or was it the early to mid 70s at the school? I forget the exact.
I thought hers was. Boy, I don't. Well, Sister Kathy was killed in 69, so she was being abused in.
Yeah, so the late 60s.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay.
And continued.
Then, right. So, and that abuse is certainly consistent with, you know, what we know about the abuse, and then the cover up of the abuse is kind of consistent with what we know about things that have happened. I mean, there's all sorts of stories now that you know about I would call it the systematic cover up of abuse in the Catholic Church through
mm-hmm.
you know, it really started coming out in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we have some issues with her account, specifically of that event. I do remember her saying that it was like the day after. I thought in the documentary she said the day after Sister Kathy went missing, Father Maskell told her, Sister Kathy is missing, but I know where she is. And so there hadn't been a whole bunch of news stories at that point, because it was just the next day. So then I do wonder.
Well, but then there wouldn't be the opportunity for decomposition.
No. So I don't know if I heard that wrong.
Yeah. I don't remember the timeline on that exactly either, but I remember the scene that you're talking about. I don't remember the timeline that they had established there.
So what's your next problem with it?
Well, spoilers.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we're going to,
you know. This whole thing is a spoiler.
Yeah. So they start, because really the abuse angle of this is sort of a side story in a way.
Yeah.
I think it, you know, it establishes, most of the time when you talk about a murder case, when they're looking for a suspect, what they're looking for is opportunity and motive. And with Father Maskell, if Sister Kathy knew about the abuse and was potentially going to take that to the authorities, you know, there is the motive, and mm-hmm. it certainly sounded like he had plenty of opportunity to, I mean, he had a lot of access to her, for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you could certainly put him on a suspect list. I mean, that's where after episode two, that's exactly where I was. It's like, okay, it's pretty clear what happened here is, you know, she was going to go to the cops, and he either killed her or hired somebody to do it, you know, or directed somebody to do it. And in fact, I was talking to somebody else after that episode, and I said, I have no idea how they're going to fill 5 more episodes. It seems pretty cut and dry to me. So what they ended up filling it with was, you know, the abuse scandal. They really dove deep into the abuse scandal, which really didn't factor in. I mean, it could have factored into the murder, but we don't really know. And that's ultimately the problem that I had with the series is I was hoping that they were going to lead us to a little bit more of a conclusion, because they really, like, they've identified a couple of people who, a couple of weird stories, the two uncles.
Yeah.
You know, Ed and Bill, I think, mm-hmm. were the two. And the whole, I'm so happy that there's a character in this story named Skippy. Nobody knows who Skippy is, but there's a couple of independent accounts of somebody named Skippy who is involved, potentially. And
yeah.
So we've got a couple of guys who had opportunity. Motive is questionable, I would say, in both of their case. I mean, they seem kind of very loosely connected to the whole puzzle, but there's a real suspicious circumstance around both of them where they both have a story of coming home
bloody,
you know, like blood on their clothes, blood on their hands, and then their families basically kind of like suppressing the story.
Yeah.
You know, but that, I mean, that quote unquote evidence in and of itself is kind of meaningless. You know, there's nothing to definitively connect them to the crime at this point.
Well, okay, but how do you think it factors in? There's a, towards the end of the series, I think it lost itself. There was a couple of episodes where I felt like this didn't need to be in here. Of course, we have to add the side note that this was about 2 murders.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And did you know that there was an additional murder that didn't get included in this series because there wasn't enough of a link between, you know, if it would have any relevance, but I forget her name, but there was a third murder of a woman around the same time. Sam, part of the Keepers, they have an official.
Of course you are.
And so I forget the other young woman's name who was murdered. That's part of the series. I can't believe I don't remember it because we sort of lose that whole tie. Clearly, they want to do the right thing and say, hey, we're including this because if we find anything, we absolutely want to help that family. Malecki. I think that was the other family.
Yeah, right. Joyce Malecki.
Yeah. So I felt a little like, okay, whatever happened to that? And I guess the third murder, they also had a lot of information and contact with the family, but they just chose not to include any of it. I suppose because this abuse thing kind of took over in a way, and so there just wasn't a place for it, is what I heard. But, okay, so we've got these two guys with these fairly odd stories that their families tell. One of them is Ed. And Ed was married at the time that this happened, and he was not a nice man. He was physical with his wife, And she was going to leave him, if you recall, but then she found out she was pregnant with twins. I hate when that happens.
And yeah, that one probably hit home a little bit, huh?
Yeah, of course, you know, not the abuse, but the part where you're like, okay.
I'm done. I guess we're doing this.
So, but he gave her a necklace for Christmas that she kept and could not understand the relevance of that necklace being what appeared to be some sort of a bell holding a green colored stone. And Ed did not initially acknowledge that necklace when he was shown a photo of it. But then when he was told that it was his wife's necklace, he commented, "That's not her birthstone," which was exactly what the wife had said in an earlier episode. She had said, "Oh, when he gave that to me, I thought, well, this is strange. This isn't even my birthstone. He never gives me jewelry. And if he did, it would be my birthstone." So he gives her this necklace that nobody is able to identify, because the night Sister Kathy went missing, one of her errands to run, she bought rolls, which were found in her car, and she was going to buy a gift, an engagement gift for her sister. And there was some question as to whether or not there was no gift found in her car. They haven't been able to even completely prove that she got a gift, right?
Right. Yeah. What we do know is that she went to her bank and cashed her paycheck. So she did have cash on her. So, you know, we don't have a transaction receipt from, you know, mm-hmm. from a gift being purchased. We don't have the physical item in the car.
Of course, a woman, remember there was a witness who stated they saw Kathy parked in her spot around 8:30 sitting in her car. And so that suggests to me that she must have completed her errands. So I'm inclined to think there had been a gift in her car.
Right. But I am inclined to agree. But we can't, like, if we're presenting this to a jury, mm-hmm. that's not good enough.
Right. So there was this gift that nobody has been able to say for sure, yes, this necklace was intended for me. But of course, the sister was getting married and her fiance's birthday was in August, which was the color of the stone in the bell. And
it was her husband's.
Yeah, at the time it was just her fiance.
Right. Yeah, okay, right. But it was, sorry, I got lost for a second.
Yeah, that's okay.
And I thought that was the part of, that was a little weird to me, was to me it would have made more sense. It would have been easier to connect if it was Kathy's sister's birthstone. But it was the birthstone of Mike, her fiance /
now husband.
Right. You know, and it's like that, to me, that seems a little weird that you would give a piece of jewelry to somebody with the intention of that person wearing it with somebody else's, you know, birthstone.
Yeah.
Like, and I guess I don't know enough about, like, I know, like, birthstone stuff was really popular in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Or 60s and 70s, you know. And so, like, would that have been a normal thing to do? Like, to give a spouse a gift or, like, a piece of jewelry to wear with their spouse's birthstone on it? That seems a little weird to me.
Yeah. Or you mean, like a gift from outside the... like, here you're getting married, I'm going to give you a gift, and in this piece of jewelry will be a birthstone of the person you're marrying.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. She was quite a thoughtful person, you know, very much into poetry. So there is something to consider as far as thinking a little more deeper and, like, here's this necklace, you're getting married, here's a reminder of this guy. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but of course, this Ed guy looks at it and then acknowledges, that he gave it to her because that's what his ex-wife said. But did you see, there's a lot of things I want to talk about. Did you see his face when he looked at the picture of Kathy? He like almost lost his shit on it.
Yeah, but also it's really, I think anything that he had to say, it's really hard to draw any conclusions on that. Because one, it was really obvious how heavily edited his statements were. Like every time they asked a question, like you could really just, it was really apparent how they're cutting that interview together. And the reason for that, in my mind, if you watch his, I mean, if you just watch his mannerisms and expressions and the way he's responding to things, he does not appear to be in his right mind anymore.
I mean, his bedroom was surrounded with teddy bears and stuff like that. You know, like he was sitting in a room. Okay, we have to take a quick break. You can keep recording, but you need to keep watching out your window, okay? Because there is a woman that's been wandering Barstow Street for years that wears the little braided pigtails in her hair.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
She's marching up and down the streets with a big orange sign. Have you seen her today? And what's the sign for?
I have no idea what it's for this time, but I have seen her do that. She does that every couple months. She's got some new sign that she's marching up and down the street for.
What were the other signs for?
One time I actually stopped and talked to her. And basically what it sounds like, so that time that I stopped and talked to her, she was talking about the importance of sending all the Jews back to Israel, to fulfill the prophecy.
Oh, okay.
So,
and she always kind of dresses like a schoolgirl or used to. I mean, I remember her being here when I was like in 95 and she looked just like that.
Yeah.
I think she's not of this world because I don't know how she's still alive and still looks the exact same.
Yeah. Yeah. She has not changed a bit since, she's been doing this. It's picked up a little more in the last couple of years, but,
wow. Okay.
She's definitely getting more reliable about having signs with her. I'll say that.
I'd never seen that. And I had to ask you about it.
Yeah.
But okay, so, Ed, yes, I know, I don't think he is in his right mind.
I don't think there's much we can really draw from Ed, unfortunately. You know, like he would have been a great person to talk to 15 or 20 years ago.
Right, and also would he? Because what is he going to say? Yeah.
Well, right, you know, but I think.
Why was he calling into a radio show talking about a crucifix he saw and then saying that he made that up?
Yeah, I mean,
that's
certainly not a thing a well-adjusted human being does, but, you know, is that the action of someone who has participated in a murder and is beginning to crack under the pressure of guilt? You know, maybe, but...
Yeah, it certainly seems like a strange coincidence that a guy who has this suspicious activity the night Sister Kathy goes missing also, you know, draws suspicion on himself by calling into this radio show, where if not for that, would they have ever made any connection? The police, not the family. But I think that was the first time the police had... I don't know. I don't know.
That's a tough case.
Yeah, they show him Father Maskell's picture. He goes, Maskell.
Right.
You know, and he seems fairly... There's no real recognition of emotion. But then they do give her Sister Kathy's photo. And, like, he looks like he's about to cry, you know.
Yeah. Maybe he was just having some, like, acid reflux. And it was just a coincidence. You know, I mean, it's really tough to draw, you know, a conclusion based on that. You know, like that's the way they cut that sequence together to make, obviously they were, that's what they were intending us to see when they were cutting that whole scene together. But I'm not overwhelmingly compelled by that.
Now, do you think that the police department was involved in the abuse? You remember there were like three different victims who spoke of seeing men in uniforms.
Yeah. And so, I mean, but none of those men were identified by the victims.
No.
They're just police officers. And so, you know, I'm not saying that I don't believe them, but it's hard to say for sure without having identities attached. And to the broader point of the, you know, of, is that was something that they had kind of tied together with sort of this idea of, the police and the legal system covering for the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And, I forget who said it. There's a great quote, that says something along the lines of, I guess it's not less of a quote, more of a paraphrase, the way I'm going to present it. But never attribute to malice what can adequately be. What was it?
We don't know.
I'm going to edit this all out. I'm going to just hang on a second. It's going to sound really smooth when I get it all. Hang on a second. Never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. And so, you know, I guess, you know, when you're talking about, you know, there are a bunch of records and things that seem to have just gone missing.
Like every record.
Well, I mean, not every single record. I mean, just most of the records.
And like the letter that Kathy sent.
Yeah, the letter is kind of what I was getting at specifically. So there was a letter that was dated after she went missing. It was postmarked after she went missing. To her sister. Her sister called the police right away. They said, don't open it. It could be evidence. A detective, plainclothes detective, came and picked it up. And she wanted to...
We think it was.
Well, we think it was, right. Yeah.
It was somebody in regular clothes.
Right. But there's a guy at the, you know, at the... Who was that guy that... sitting at the table, gray-haired guy... Who was talking about the letter? I forget what he.
He was the current investigator on the case. The guy.
Oh, the current investigator. Okay.
Yes, and he was. They had record of a letter, and what was written on the outside of the letter, but no letter and no indication to what the contents was.
Right.
So I guess we should assume that the letter was picked up by a police officer. Or a detective of some kind. I had been skeptical that it was somebody who should have the letter at all, but
right. So, but like that's a case where, and I just have a feeling with a lot of these older cold cases, and I guess I don't want to, like run anyone down. Or maybe say people aren't doing their jobs as well as they could in some of these government offices. But, you know, maybe things get moved around. You know, like they decide, you know, like let's just say they decide to they need this evidence room for another purpose. And so all this evidence needs to be moved somewhere else. And something gets misplaced. Or
how about those boxes of documents that Maskell had buried
in
the back of a cemetery.
That's a little more weird.
And then that Sharon May was
that's another case where you kind of have to decide It's word against word, and you sort of have to decide who you think is more credible. And what she said. So who is the witness who said he saw? He was on the scene and saw, like, the pictures.
Yeah, that was one of the detectives who is their deep throat.
Right. Okay. So an anonymous source.
Yeah.
Which I'm always a little more skeptical of someone who's not willing to go on record. That doesn't mean that it's not true. But it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody who is willing to go on record is telling the truth. It's like reading a news story, and there's a lot of them nowadays talking about current situations, like in the White House, that are, a White House official says blank, or someone close to the president says blank. Mm-hmm. It's like those stories to me are meaningless unless somebody's willing to go on the record and say, this is what's happening, because an anonymous source or a source close, somebody literally could just make that up and print the story and say, oh yeah, I have an anonymous source. They just didn't want to give me their name.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, do you think a detective on this case would be wise to give his name?
If no, there certainly, is some certainly
kind of a cover up going on.
Certainly not. But that doesn't move us any closer to understanding what's going on. But I guess that's more for him to know than for us to know. Mm-hmm. So just in the I guess I'm saying in the context of where the series leaves us, a nameless detective saying he saw something doesn't compel me to, that's not really influencing my view of what happened one way or the other. It's like, I don't know him. I don't know what, I don't know that he's actually a detective, or if they just threw somebody in a room and disguised his voice. You know what I mean? Maybe I'm I'm a little too cynical, but people do some weird stuff to make a compelling story. I guess one more thing to talk about, talking about, what's her name? May.
Susan?
Susan May, was that
Yeah,
it?
The yeah. head of the sex...
Right, the sex crimes division. Yeah, yeah, right. In Baltimore, is it the city of Baltimore or Baltimore County? I forget exactly what.
I think it was Baltimore County.
Okay. Somebody was asking. They were asking why there weren't charges brought up in the case of Father Maskell, and I think. She has there's a couple of tough circumstances where they have the statute of limitations thing going on. Mm-hmm. The statute of limitations is 7 years. I did appreciate that they included at the very end of the series the effort to the legal effort to extend the statute of limitations in sexual abuse cases.
I thought it was 3 years.
Was it 3 years? I thought it was seven. I thought at the end they were when they were describing that process. Okay. I thought they said seven. Maybe it is three. But the one thing that that I'm just gonna roll with the fact that her name is Susan May said is that they can't use the number of people coming forward as evidence to move forward with a criminal case. Like, each individual case has to stand on its own, mm-hmm. And when you're beyond the statute of limitations and when you're relying on decades old memory, like, how, And I don't want to be insensitive to the victims, but like, how do you move forward with a criminal case in that circumstance? You know, it's sort of like, I guess sort of like the Bill Cosby case right now is like, they had to wait until there was somebody who came forward that was still within, you know, the statute of limitations to actually, you know, press charges.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you want to, I guess you kind of want to be careful about, you know, if you, I mean, the statute of limitations is there to protect innocent people as well. So you got to be careful to, you know, like if you're going to move that bar, you know, you gotta be real deliberate with it. You know, because I mean, if I don't know, I mean, it's a really tough circumstance to both serve the victims, you know, and pursue the justice that they deserve, and to also protect innocent people.
Yeah, and of course, I do think you must have to agree that we have this dentist towards the end of the series talking about things that happened to him in 1967, and his memories weren't recovered. I mean, he's had these memories, and his mother went and spoke with the church. The church met with him, yet there's no documentation of his mom going to speak with anybody about it. But miraculously, the next year, Father Maskell was transferred from their school. So I think to myself, that just to me supports everything I think about the church's systemic cover up and need to save face as far as credibility for their religion. I don't know. Did you believe that guy?
I did. And again, that's one of those things that, like, his story and that the alleged action that the church took to move Father Maskell and cover it up is totally consistent with, you know, hundreds or thousands of other stories that we've heard about the Catholic Church, especially in that era.
And they asked him, what do you want? Because by the time they met with him, I think these other proceedings had been, I don't know what year in the 90s they met with him or if it was in the 80s, but he had a meeting with some higher ups at some point after his abuse, and he was already a successful dentist, and they asked him, what do you want? Do you want a boat?
Right.
And then, of course, I wondered about, or is it Susan or Sharon May, that woman? Okay, she had to mention her red car that she drove. You know, and then I was wondering, where'd you get that red car from?
Right.
I don't know.
There's no question. I mean, she came across as a dipshit. You know, I mean, so I don't want to sit here and pretend like I'm just like, I'm going to defend her. Merle's being a very good dog right now. You know, I'm certainly not coming to her defense or the defense of her character. They definitely portrayed her as a villain, and I don't know if there's a lot of circumstantial stuff that they pointed to that where you could say like, yeah, it seems a little shady, but like, it's hard to say, you know, like I'm not 100% convinced that there's that level of a cover up, like from a law enforcement standpoint, but I can't say that there's not
33 priests that had been outed by the church at some point.
It was a list of like 50 that the church had published.
Yeah. And none of them had any sort of prosecution against them, except for one was found guilty because he admitted to it.
Right, he pled guilty. Yeah. Now, I guess the other thing that I don't know is when if somebody makes an accusation. If somebody comes forward and makes an accusation of abuse, what, I mean, theoretically, I mean, what, boy, I don't really want to tread carefully because I really don't like, I don't want to be insulting to victims, you know. This is a legitimate question. Like, what is the threshold of evidence for abuse? Mm-hmm. You know, especially if some time has passed. And I don't know, like, in that list of 50 priests that the church had published compared to the where the criminal proceedings were that obviously never went forward. You know, I don't know what the, you know, obviously not all of those were decades old cases. Mm-hmm. You know, so what I guess what I don't know and what I would like the answer to is like what is the threshold of evidence for a like charges to be brought against an abusive priest? You know, is the word of one person good enough? You know, because, I mean...
Well, obviously not.
Right. I mean, and we're talking about, like, theoretically in an unbiased and uncorrupt world. You know, like, if we're, you know... I don't know. I don't really know how to resolve that into a real question.
Yeah, because it feels like it should be, because if it happened to you, that's all you should have to say.
Right. But if, like, say somebody had motivation to defame that person, they could just say, oh, that person abused me, even if it didn't happen. You know, and then how, like, then you have a word against word situation. Mm-hmm. And like, how do you resolve that? You know, like,
yeah, right.
So
yeah, I don't know.
You know, so like, how do you, I mean, I don't know. That's sort of a tough circumstance. So, and I wonder if that's one of the reasons why there weren't more charges pressed in those kind of cases where they were more, it certainly seemed like the church was more likely to pay, I guess the reparations or whatever, you know, and the perception of that is that, especially since a lot of those priests were just shuffled around and, you know, it seemed like there was no discipline being brought against them. But I wonder, could some of that have been because it is difficult to bring charges against somebody based on a word? You know, I mean, certain, not to be on the corner of the Catholic Church.
No, I don't know. I don't know. But I have to ask, mm-hmm, before we wrap this up. Does it make sense to you that Jerry Koob is the guy who she had some sort of attachments to?
They were boning.
Well, I don't know. I mean, she wrote a letter to... Okay. She wrote him a letter typed that they found. And in that letter, she wants to have his children, et cetera, et cetera. And also, it made it sound as though she had been worried she was pregnant.
Right.
But then he says to everybody that he proposed to her and she turned him down. So do you think that he was at all involved, or do you think either of the three people that were at the house, Kathy's apartment, her roommate, Jerry, or the other priest that came with him, do you think any of those three people were involved in this or know something more?
Well, it's hard to say. And, you know, the other component that we really hadn't addressed is Brother Bob.
Yeah. Who is that?
And who knows? You know, like, I wondered if they were angling the creators of the series were angling to make Jerry Coob Brother Bob.
Really? See, I didn't pick up on that.
I don't know if that's really where they kind of left off, but I kind of felt like in a couple of spots that's you know kind of where they were trying to steer it a little bit. They're trying to kind of steer the narrative that maybe he was involved in some level, you know, maybe he was Brother Bob, but you know, I mean, Brother Bob literally, we were talking about a recovered memory from a somewhat suspicious source who, like, she could remember a couple of, like, marks on his body, but she couldn't remember his face or his identity or, you know, so...
Maybe there was no Brother Bob.
Maybe there was no Brother Bob. That's kind of also where I was left. Maybe she never saw the body. Maybe there was no Brother Bob.
And Jerry Coob says he's at the police station. And, of course, there were some indications that maybe the police were supposed to back off of him. Do you remember that part?
Yeah, right.
But he claims they brought in Kathy's vagina wrapped in newspaper.
Right, yeah.
Now what?
Yeah, I don't know where that's coming from, because that is like that just seems like no way.
Like, that no. Seems like no way.
Yeah, I mean.
So I don't know if I'm supposed to believe a guy who says a thing like that.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, I don't know. That's I would really love to see some of these interviews unedited.
Well, and you know, also, I will tell you that the group online found a newspaper article that came out shortly after the car was discovered, which Kathy's car was discovered magically parked askew right near her apartment building with twigs in it, mud everywhere. And in the series, Jerry says that he and the other pastor or priest went for a walk and walked down the street and found the car. Now, in the newspaper article I read that came out shortly after, it was all three of them went for a walk, including Russell Phillips, who was Kathy's roommate and another nun. And I just don't know. It had to be somebody who knew where... It couldn't have... The stranger theory doesn't work for me. Unless the stranger found her outside her apartment and figured, I'll bring her car back. And that, I don't understand why anybody brought her car back anywhere near that.
No, I think that does suggest familiarity. You mm-hmm. know, it's...
Like somebody who didn't want to have to go far to get to where they lived. Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, it's kind of tough to reconcile, but it does seem to suggest that whoever brought that car there knew where she lived or knew approximately where she lived.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and instead of, yeah, and maybe they weren't entirely sure, so they just, and they really haphazardly parked it. And then I even thought to myself, a cop came, responded to their call about the missing person. That car must not have been there at that time, because you think the police officer would have noticed it.
Yeah, a car parked.
Yeah.
You know, half in the street, kind of.
So then maybe those three weren't directly involved. There's so much to talk about. I mean,
I know it's
the student who came the night before, and Maskell and Magnus showed up at Kathy's apartment and opened the door. The anonymous student who said the night before Kathy went missing, she came to speak with Kathy along with the student's boyfriend about the abuse. And in the course of their conversation, Magnus and Maskell show up unannounced and just come into her apartment.
Right.
I mean, it's all... Anyway, okay.
Yeah.
After the series.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you have any inclinations about what happened?
Yeah, I think, that Maskell and or Magnus were definitely involved. I think either Maskell killed Sister Kathy himself or had somebody else do it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that that Ed and Bill and Skippy helped dispose of the body.
Yeah.
You know, it's. But I mean, that's kind of. I mean, it almost seems too cut and dry. You know that. Sister Kathy was, you know, talking about doing something about the abuse that was happening in that school. And, obviously Maskell and Magnus had a lot at stake if she were going to do that. I don't know that I necessarily believe in a big, broad law enforcement cover up. I think that is more, I think that has, I mean, there may be some on some level, but I think I would attribute most of that to, the difficulty in prosecuting that type of case, especially in the 70s. Incompetence and bad luck as far as, you know, like mm-hmm. the unfortunate things happening to evidence.
Maskell's brother was on the police department, wasn't he?
Yeah, you're right, and that which raises suspicions, but that doesn't necessarily. It doesn't. I mean, it raises suspicions, but it's hard to draw a hard conclusion just based on that. Just because he was his brother doesn't mean that there's a logical fallacy called ad hoc ergo proctor hoc, which is, you know, this thing happened, therefore this is the result. And so just because Maskell's brother was on the police force doesn't mean that there was a police cover up.
Right.
It raises suspicions, but, you know, you can't draw a conclusion based just on that.
Yeah, it also raises suspicions about police being involved in the abuse themselves.
Certainly.
But
again,
guess what? Guess what I'm going to say?
What?
I agree with you.
Really? Interesting.
Yep.
Nothing to add?
Nope.
Just I nailed it, huh?
Yep.
Well, this has not been so much a shorty as a...
It's a talkie. Yes, Sam. We're into the talkies. Those talkies.
You know, a lot of the cops in those pictures, if you look at the pictures,
yeah.
It looks like that's how they should sound.
I know. Have a weird week, say.